Hi guys, I'm Dana Al-Hanbali, and this is Something to Consider. Do you remember the last time you were completely immersed in a story? Whether it was a conversation, a podcast, a book, or a movie, stories have a unique way of captivating us. Film, in particular, is fascinating because it represents a universal language, a medium through which humanity's most profound, nuanced, and diverse experiences are expressed and shared. Film has the remarkable ability to transcend borders, cultures, and languages, connecting people through emotion, perspective, and imagination. In a world that often feels fragmented, film has the power to unify. It reminds us of our shared humanity while celebrating the richness of our differences. It's more than entertainment. It's a tool that educates, inspires, and, dare I say, heals. My next guest is an entrepreneur, a cultural advocate, and the visionary founder of Cinema Aqil, the first independent art house cinema in the Gulf region. From its early beginnings as a nomadic platform to becoming a cultural landmark in Dubai's Al Sirkal Avenue, Cinema Aqil does more than showcase films. It has created a community united by cinema, a lens through which society is reflected, perceptions are challenged, and conversations that matter are sparked. Whether we're talking about film as a mirror, a bridge, a catalyst, or even a time capsule, her mission to bring thought-provoking stories to life has made her a trailblazer in the UAE's cultural landscape. Buthain Al-Kadhim, thank you for being here and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dana. It's really great to be here.
Absolutely. I'm so happy to finally have you. Cinema Aqil, in a very strange way, has been this... I remember, especially living in Kuwait, it was always something we used to reference as a voice on its own. And I really appreciate that about what you've been able to build. So when I met you this year, it was such a beautiful cosmic moment of being able to kind of understand the story behind it and how it came to be. But before we begin, I'd love to give the audience a bit of context about you. What can you tell us about your background, the context of your story, to kind of preface the conversation we're going to have?
Oh, man. I mean, I've always like said this, you know, I wish I had this moment of like this aha story to kind of share about how I came to, you know, create a cinema, right? Like there's this romantic vision of, you know, El Cinema, Cinema Paradiso, you know, the kid peeking from behind the curtains, you know, grew up around projectors and the smell of, you know, 36 millimeter film. I don't have that story. The first film, you know, I saw in a theater was probably, I want to say, maybe Little Mermaid in Awal Cinema in Bahrain, you know, or one of the multiplexes here. I did grow up around film in different iterations, but I also grew up around stories, I guess, like most of us here in the region. Mm-hmm. And I think it was, you know, a combination of my, you know, love for kind of love and curiosity and recognition of sort of the power of representation that mm-hmm. ultimately drew me to create something, you know, that would be a world of worlds, you know, and that to me is what cinema represents. I started off as a, you know, as a graphic designer out of school. And that came again from the sort of this, you know, itch to tell, like kind of to visualize or to represent or to present or project, you know, images from our region. The industry itself and the work itself didn't end up, you know, kind of speaking to me or translating the sort of hunger I had to bring together the world of representation of, you know, arts and culture and the combination of, you know, a sort of a wider audience and speaking to a wide audience. And that was something that I always felt was, if I am to think of it now in retrospect, like the Venn diagram was always that sort of trifecta, you know, of sort of a mass scale, of representation and of the arts. And that was, you know, what media was. So I ended up, you know, switching to the media industry, working in television. I worked for a TV, like, well, a project that didn't end up coming to life. It was meant to do what I kind of do now, you know, with art house cinema and cultural production to a free-to-air, you know, 360 million person audience on Arabic language satellite TV, right? So I was doing that kind of work. And kind of that whole thing flipped, you know, to a micro scale, one screening at a time, one cinema at a time. But in a way, the mission was sort of consistent, right? I always was angry in a way, or, you know, agitated by the way that we understood ourselves, you know, or we were understood. And, you know, the initial and the naivete kind of, you know, stage of it was the just this sort of frustration, you know, coming out of university or going into university after 9/11, you know, 2001. I think like every Arab or even person from, you know, brown person from the Swana region probably remembers where they were,
100%.
You know, at that time. And I think until today, witnessing a genocide happen, you know, in our neighborhood, you know, our people, our friends, our, you know, our everyday, and this sort of being perplexed by this, you know, kind of desensitization around it is an extension of that, is an extension of the effect that we got used to, this kind of, you know, proliferation of the definition of terrorist, you know, normalizing the way that our region is kind of the apex of that, is kind of the apex of, you know, destruction and chaos and catastrophe and the victimization. And all of that, you take this legacy from 2001 until today, can lead to this, you know, effect of solidifying or normalizing a way that we are viewed and the way that we are ultimately considered, you know, sacred or human. Right. So this is, you know, maybe a massive leap, but that's the thought process of image making and, you know, idea kind of commodification. And I was in 2001, sort of, you know, at the very early stages without a lot of this ability to, you know, to reflect, which is what I can kind of verbalize now, still kind of like, you know, in shock, you know, by this, by what was happening very quickly. And that sort of initially, if I think about it today, what maybe, you know, seeded this idea that, you know, I need to do something to be part of an alternative way of being seen. And before it was like this sort of urgency, you know, of no, like you need to just understand us. And if you understand us, then you know, you're going to change your stereotypes about us and you're no longer going to, you know, kill us, or you're no longer going to be afraid of us, you know? And this was sort of, you know, this naivete of like speaking to a primarily like Western audience or being concerned with the Western audience. You know, a lot has changed since then, you know, both in my trajectory and my understanding and the way that media works, you know, and obviously sociopolitically in our region and geopolitically also. But that kind of iota of a realization, I think, was in a way always there, you know, and that's if I were to kind of go back to this one through line, it probably was this thing of wanting to, you know, have our own voice. And now it's more concerned with having our own voice to ourselves. So, wow. Yeah, I think that's in a nutshell, like what I can think of right now. Yeah.
I mean, that's great context. I've heard you talk before about you see yourself as someone who's in the business of wanting to make people feel. And I feel like you've kind of found a way to articulate that in terms of what image making or film does. But how do you take that feeling, that will, that drive, and turn it into cinema aqil? First of all, where does the name come from? And two, I mean, how do you pitch an idea like this to someone? How do you turn it into this physical space that now garners a community?
I mean, look, we didn't have a very, like most of my stories or my journey, it really hasn't been linear, right? It's been very iterative and it continues to be very iterative. And I've sort of gotten to a point now, like a decade into the you know, the experience where I'm leaning into that, you know, iteration-based process. You know, we started off in 2014 as a pop-up cinema. And our first pop-up was in a gallery called the Third Line Gallery, which was founded by three, you know, very like fresh, you know, gallerists that wanted that I think were kind of the seeds of what became the art scene in Dubai. It was a small warehouse in Alcoz before Alcoz became cool, you know, and they brought in, you know, some of the, like they started to platform, you know, some of what we think of today as like, you know, the biggest names in the regional art scene, like Farah Al-Qasimi, like, you know, the late Farhad Mushiri or Munir Farman Farmayan or Fouad Khoury, Joanna Hadji Toma or Khalil Jrej, like they started representing them in this region. And what they wanted to do was also create a space for, you know, collaboration. So everybody that wanted to do something today, you know, and alhamdulillah, it's amazing. Like, you know, now, you know, you have, you're spoiled for choice in terms of, you know, spaces and collaborators. Back then, like-minded individuals who really were invested in creating a discursive space were limited. And it was one of the co-founders, Sunny Rahbar, who was a dear friend, that said, you know what, you want to do this? You know, you're trying to set up an art house cinema. And my thing was like, okay, you know, we got to start building. We got to start having a, you know, brick and mortar space. But before that, I wanted to just test out, like stress test this concept, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is there an actual audience for this? Is there in Dubai right now the appetite to do this? Or, and you got to remember, this is Dubai, you know, 2014, right? Where still there was a suspicion that, you know, everybody here was not interested in anything like intellectual. They were interested in creating and building and, you know, in making money and like, you know, in kind of relishing in the high life, right? That Dubai was sort of synonymous with. And that a lot of that has to do with image making, right? We were like, you know what? Let's put our heads together. Let's see what we can create over a summer season and put together a smorgasbord of a lineup under the name Cinema Aqil. Okay. And I'll get to the name. And it was, you know, everything from, we opened with Anne-Marie Jasser's Lemma Shuftak, which is, you know, and we've shown every single one. So Anne-Marie and her films, like, we have a very long, you know, kind of like history by now, you know, whether it's showing her films at Cinema Aqil. Her film, Milhu Hadha al-Bahar, or Salt of the Sea, was the first film I bought in acquisitions when I was working for TV. And then, you know, Lemma Shuftak became the first film I ever showed, you know, in under the name Cinema Aqil. We opened with her film, and then we had, you know, Alfred Hitchcock's Dial M for Murder. We had Pablo Larraín's No about the fall of Pinochet and the advertising campaign that, you know, that led to that. Hirokazu Koreeda's like Father Like Son, and Satyajit Rai's Pathar Panchali, part of the Apu trilogy.
This was all something that was happening that summer.
That was a summer test case, basically. We were, you know, they opened up the space. The gallery opened up the space for us to take over. And we were doing Cinema Aqil screenings every, it was like once a week for from July until August, until end of August. And we had, you know, introductions. We had, you know, Manusha Street snacks on the side. We had like rainbow bean bags. And it was very rough around the edges, you know, the setup. But the spirit was there. And most importantly, the audience showed up, right? This was summer in Dubai where the mass exodus had happened. And people were still interested. They were still hungry for this. And they hung around after. They wanted a space to come together and not just watch the films, right? Ultimately, the films, you, if you really were insistent, you would find them somewhere. And I always say this, and I say this today even more so with the proliferation of VOD. But it is about the moments before and after. It is about the moments of silence. It's about the moments of, you know, of coming together, of community, that we really wanted to. It became a space not only about cinema, it became a space for people to coexist under the protection or the sanctuary of a cinema space. And that's how I think of cinema today, outside of the black box model that we're so kind of used to. Cinema Aqil, the name Aqil comes from the Arabic word al-aql, and it just means, you know, somebody who's the wise and also in a way compassionate. So it was sort of a personification of what we were trying to bring to Dubai and bring to the region ultimately. And then kind of, you know, created a sort of a soul of its own.
Wow. I love that. How are you able to fund this into a fully functioning business and one that has now expanded into Bahrain, right?
So we have been doing pop-ups since 2014, right? Okay. 2014 was our first iteration, as I explained. And then since then, since doing that experiment, we said, you know what, let's park the idea of opening up a physical brick and mortar space, you know, until we are able to raise, you know, the funds and also test our assumptions about what people want, right? Because art house and the visualization of art house and the language of art house also is very tied with models that exist primarily in the West, right? So there was, you know, the easy way would have been to, hey, we love the electric cinema, you know, in Notting Hill, and we'll just create something that looks like that. And I had spent a 2-month fellowship in between Berlin and Regensburg in the south of Germany, researching art house cinemas, right? So like I went to every single art house cinema I could see. I wanted to see the common denominators, and I studied a lot of that kind of the language, the visual language, the architecture, the space, the divisions, what we would need, functionality, operations, etc. And you know, there was a kind of a universal language, I want to say, of, you know, of European art houses that also kind of, you know, translated to, if you look at art houses in North America, also picked up from that model with a larger scale Nickelodeon based kind of structure. And you know, I wanted to see what it would mean to create art house in our region. So, you know, doing pop-ups really allowed us to have that slow and steady trickle of information, feedback, responsiveness, you know, test really like what kind of physical space we would translate this into. And every pop-up was a physical space that was temporary or, you know, ephemeral or a mirage. So those were mini opportunities for us not only to build a community and to kind of connect with different audiences in different places, but also, you know, gather that information and that sort of longevity. So that took about 4 years for us to get to the point where we actually opened, you know, physical doors. Oh, wow. Of doing, I think by the time we opened, we had done about 45 pop-ups, maybe more, in different locations across the UAE, Dubai, Sharjah, Abu Dhabi at that point. We opened in 2017 a collaboration with Al Serkal Avenue, which again, I go back to, you know, the importance of partnership or allyship in like-minded, you know, partners along the way that have been part of the journey and been part of the initial takeoff, you know, that we had to pitch, but also understood the importance, you know, in and of themselves and inherently to what they did. So Al Serkal was one of those spaces and one of those partners. And they said, you know what, we have this warehouse, our purpose-built warehouses. You can, you know, test out, like you can use it, you know, for the cinema. And we said, you know what we're going to do is actually now run a simulation for 3 months over the summer again, of ticketed, you know, operations every single day of the, every single night of the week. So that's what we did. 2017, we collaborated with Shab Moha and Chindi, these two artists, to design the space and create a kind of temporary experience of what this art house would look like. And a lot of the elements, like, you know, the wallpaper, for example, was from that collaboration. And, you know, the single brief was like, you can't drill a single nail into the wall because we didn't know if we were going to stay. You know, we had community members and folks donating seats and couches and, you know, and furniture to the space. We had artists who had, you know, part of their like poster projects or whatever that, you know, that were inspired by regional cinema that were, you know, bringing them to us. The wall that we had behind the counter still lives in the cinema today. So that sort of iterative sort of relationship was sort of part of the DNA. And we ran it over the summer. It worked really well. We opened with Raoul Peck's I Am Not Your Negro and Tamer Saeed's In the Last Days of the City, Akhir Ayam al-Madina, starring Khalid Abdullah. And, you know, it was fantastic. It was very different. It was scary because it was the first time that we went from a public, you know, free screening model that is commissioned to a physical ticketed platform.
I love that. I love that because I feel like also in the building of your story, there were so many people that were part of it. And so much of what you said about this idea of people contributing pieces, you know, this bespoke wallpaper, this counter, whatever, it reminds me so much of how, you know, places in Lebanon or in Jordan kind of came to be. The community had a part in building and telling that story. And a lot of people, for some odd reason, don't want to believe that we have that here in the UAE. But, you know, I was lucky. I graduated from a US in Sharjah. I got a chance to really get to know so many people from the Emirati community. And I feel like this is very much something that is embedded here. But the fact that you were able to draw it into your business and this experience is quite beautiful.
Yeah, look, I mean, the road less traveled in the sense of, you know, it's harder, it takes longer, it requires a lot of trust, it requires a lot of investment in, you know, in the relationships ultimately that you want to cultivate, because it's not a relationship that's transactional, 100%. Right? You're not like just working with, you know, contractors and, you know, and a designer with a fee. Mm. Like you are building something with someone. Mm. And that requires a lot of synchronicity, a lot of ability to think long term. But I think the payout is just so much more, you know, tremendous and rewarding and even lucrative, you know, on both fronts. And you can see El Serkal Avenue as a result of that 100%. As a space. Today we see El Serkal as like, oh, you know, everybody knows it. It's like the cool place to go. But, you know, they started off with that in mind, is that they brought folks into the space with that spirit of, you know, building long-term relationships, you know, and that's why we continue to renew our vows, you know, because it makes sense. Like even with all of its changes, you know, now the business speaks for itself, right? Mm-hmm. The real estate model, you know, of these purpose-built warehouses that are carefully curated are, you know, have kind of created a case study for Dubai to learn from. Mm-hmm. And it's also affected legislation. It's affected zoning. It's affected public transport routes, because there is clearly a use case, you mm-hmm. know, that was formidable, you know, and I think everything starts off that way. So what I was doing was kind of creating mini moments of like proof of concepts, right? Prototypes, every single pop-up that look, people are going to show up around cinema. People are going to linger. People are going to, you know, make friends and share ideas. And people are going to spend money on popcorn. Mm. And people are going to, you know, come to your space in Mina Zayed in Abu Dhabi, you know, in a new, you know, art space. If you bring those stories to life, and if you bring them the stories they want to see, and if you bring them the version of themselves, you know, in a way, ultimately, mm. that they are, they can aspire to, or are curious about, or they would, they're curious to at least like confront, you know, and that's what we did, you know, from Warehouse 421 in Abu Dhabi. That was the first kind of entry point. We, you know, we started doing pop-ups. I mean, everywhere you could think of, you know, a format like the five-person cinema that we built in Maraya Art Center in mm. In Sharjah, mm. in Flag Island. You know, we did 1,500, you know, unseated cine concert at mm. Meet D3 at Dubai Design District. We did, you know, programs on a basketball court mm. at Soul DXB in the initial stages.
Yeah.
You know, cinema in the desert, cinema on the beach, mm. cinema in Market Outside the Box by Burj Khalifa in Southridge downtown. Like it was everything, because we wanted to see, first of all, we wanted to showcase, you know, how cinema has a place in every aspect of life, right? Every aspect that may be commercial, right? But has a component that allows you to step out of the moment mm. and trace back either a sentiment or a historical trajectory of what that moment represented. So if Soul DXB was the moment where, you know, you see the best of both regional and international, you know, streetwear and hip hop and lifestyle of that kind of physical translation, the cinema and the film that you would watch, like a film like Fresh Dressed by Sasha Jenkins, was where you understood where that streetwear came from mm. and the politics that surrounded that streetwear.
But let's stop there, because I feel like, I mean, there's something, we keep talking about art house, first of all. I would like to kind of solidify that definition a little bit more for our listeners, because clearly you made this conscious decision to focus on independent art house films versus mainstream or a lot of the films that we would probably see in commercial cinemas. What is the fundamental reason behind that? So if you could just start by kind of defining what does art house cinema mean, and why did you consciously make that choice? Because I agree with you. You are taking people out of the context of where they are physically and putting them in a moment, or to the first point, you're giving them an opportunity to feel something.
Look, defining art house is almost impossible, right? Because it isn't a single fixed mode. Like there, you know, we throw those terms around like commercial or art house. There are films that are on the cusp. There are films that are, ultimately it's films that are made outside of the traditional studio model, right? Okay. Films that are not necessarily, they could be commercially successful, but they're not necessarily driven or exclusively created with that kind of commercial success or the distribution model, you know, in mind. So the primary kind of function or the primary raison d'etre of making that story is something more existential, you know, mm-hmm. something more, whether it's, you know, it's archiving, whether it's, you know, a curiosity around something, whether it's the art form, whether it's a technique, whether it's, you know, the drama, whether it's the story, you know, itself. Like those are there, you know, there is a component that is inexplicably, you know, artistic. The invisibilia of that surrounds it, you know, is what governs that film. And I say this very openly because I think, you know, there's a lot of debate around this, like, because there are films that are, you know, art house, technically they were created outside the studio space, but they have been, you know, huge commercial successes, right? And they did go through the traditional route of festival circuit to the theater, to VOD and so on. A film, a great example of that is Parasite, you know, the Korean film that won the host of Academy Awards and Best Picture, which, you know, broke the record. But ultimately, like the kind of the structure of it exists outside of traditional commercial entertainment spaces. It's not exclusively created with that in mind. So there is an element of that. And then the second component is sort of where those films live, right? So they can live, you know, primarily in the festival circuit. They end up having a sort of critical acclaim that is literary, that is contribution to the, you know, the sort of the art forms of humanity in a way. Like it goes into that, you know, nobody thinks of, you know, kind of commercial or mainstream, you know, Hollywood output as exclusively that. It can become that. And that's why we do classic cinema, you know, from
the Godfather.
Hollywood as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You have films like, you know, Francis Ford Coppola's work and, you know, Martin Scorsese's work that ends up being part of that, you know, cult following. But for me, it wasn't necessarily so much about that as much as it was about fixing the discrepancy or the disproportionality by which we were allowed access or given access to films from the non-Western world, from the non-Euro-Amerocentric perspective. So that was the driver. You know, it was more, it wasn't necessarily like where the structure of the film came from as much as it was that, you know, we were trying to showcase films that were underrepresented, you know, like the underdogs of cinema sometimes, but also films that are quite successful. A film like Nadine Labaki's Kafar Nahoum, for example, you know, it became that crossover between the two. And because, you know, she as a, you know, filmmaker was able to bridge that gap and kind of create a language that spanned both the sort of the commercial audiovisual space and as a music director initially, right, to the world of film with all of her, with her entire filmography. And for me, it was more about that. It's about becoming a champion of our region and also owning our voice and being very conscious of the fact that we're in Dubai, right? We're in Dubai. We're surrounded by these incredible stories and these cinema histories that we don't know anything about so much. You know, we know Bollywood and we know, you know, Hollywood and we know commercial Egyptian cinema primarily, right? But we don't know the sort of actual like contribution that, you know, all of these films like Bengali cinema, Iranian cinema, you know, independent, even Palestinian resistance cinema has had on cinemas of the world. You know, there's a great, you know, critic, film critic that made us, there's a 13 part series called The Story of Film. And you watch that, like it kind of shows you the entire trajectory of cinema. And you're just incredibly like blown away by the contribution of our regional cinema to how storytelling manifested and how major Hollywood stories today actually have a lot of, you know, things to that they owe to cinema that came from this part of the world. So a big part of that tall order was for us on a micro level to be a space, to be the first port of call for the films that came out of the region. And the initial frustration for me was that it was easier to watch a Tunisian film, a Lebanese film, Palestinian film in France or in Berlin than it would be to watch it, or even in New York when I was living there, you know, than it would be to watch it
in the region
here, you know, in my backyard. So it was also a selfish kind of desire to like bridge that gap and like watch it with, you know, folks that were also feeling that same frustration.
I mean, that's a perfect segue into kind of the next point. You've invested a lot of time. I mean, in November, you had an Arab Cinema Week or month. I don't remember. Week. But it was a week. And one thing that caught my eye was your investment in Real Palestine, which for me has become almost a sub-brand or a brand by itself. You know, you talk about especially film in Palestine or by Palestinians has in many ways been a form of resistance because it represents more than just telling a story. It's about also reclaiming stories, which speaks to the power of storytelling. So I'm curious, what was the spark for the Real Palestine series? Where did that come from?
Look, Real Palestine was founded by a group of individuals, volunteers, you know, who wanted to bring Palestinian cinema to an audience here in the UAE. And, you know, the founding members that are still, you know, working with us today in an advisory capacity, you know, like Dan Assad, Nadia Rushdie, there was around, at that time, there was Noor Al Husseini, Baha Kayali, Ali Aboutina. You know, these are folks that were really just wanting to create a festival, a Palestinian film festival, you know, for the region, which is ironically not something that existed anywhere. We were showing Palestinian films and everybody, you know, Metropolis in Beirut or, you know, all the art houses in the region like Zawiya Cinema, they're all showing Palestinian cinema, but never in the context of a festival. And we got used to, and I went to school in North America, right? And that was where the concept, Aslan, of a Palestinian film festival was sort of, you know, brought to life or sort of culminated.
Wow.
So funny enough, you know, we wanted to replicate that model and bring it home. And it wasn't, you know, so it wasn't something we created as Cinema Aqil. We collaborated. It was initially a collaboration in our pop-up spaces. So when we were doing pop-ups in El Serkal, we kind of worked together with Real Palestine, what they were doing. And it was a, you know, it was a small and growing community. Obviously, they were, you know, the proof of concept was there that people really wanted to come together and, you know, watch these films. We had, you know, the platform and the expertise to kind of expand and help, you know, help bring a, you know, a footfall and a sort of institutionalization of the festival. And we kind of grew together. And then 2 years ago, we took over the sort of the management continuity of Real Palestine and became part of Cinema Aqil's annual, you know, calendar. It became something that I don't like to refer to it as a brand so much because it's more of a concept, you know, an idea than it is a brand. But it is something that we kind of are kind of custodians of, and we're very proud of it and very proud of, you know, the kind of stories we've been able to showcase that outside of, you know, a Real Palestine space and visibility may have not been as, you know, visible. And, you know, Real Palestine is many different things. It's everything from the souq, you know, where we have, you know, artisans and Palestinian, you know, concepts and brands and, you know, retailers that come from Palestine sometimes, you know, to showcase at the souq. We have, you know, arts institutions collaborations. So we do, you know, video artwork and photography sometimes that we collaborate with different institutions like Gulf Photo Plus and other galleries like Zawiya. And of course, primarily the key component of it is the cinema, is the film component, which is you know, everything from shorts to feature documentaries, feature narratives, usually from the past 2 years, mostly from the past year. And so every once in a while we have a classic lineup. So either something from the archive or, you know, like we did the retrospective of Michel Khleifi's work, and obviously not the whole thing because we don't have enough time or space, but we showed, you know, four of his best films biggest known films. And that's, in a way, it's a space for discovery. It's a space for, you know, putting Palestine on the, you know, audiovisual map exclusively outside of the Arab Cinema Week, and give it its own rightful space.
Also for discourse. Like, there's a lot of investment, Buthaina, that you put into Real Palestine. I mean, clearly there's a personal connection there. There's a passion for it. Something's driving it. Because I've attended, you know, those screenings, and there's a very conscious effort to follow that up with either, you know, the director will come and speak about the film, or there'll be some sort of a round table, even unofficially in some cases. I've seen it happen right outside the doors of Cinema Aqil. And I'm wondering, was that something that was consciously part of the intention?
Of course. I mean, it's something that, you know, like creating a safe space means all of the above, right? It's showcasing the work and showcasing the creator, showcasing the miraculous process by which Palestinian film gets to be made today. If you think about it, like, it should be an impossibility, right? It should be something that, you know, like, we talk about these films from the region as though they exist on the same plane as films, you know, everywhere else, or even specifically in Europe and North America. The independent cinema scene, or the process of getting your film made or funded or, you know, created, or even researching what it takes to actually research a single title, is a whole other journey. It's almost impossible for so many reasons, from actual war, you know, mm-hmm. to the absence of archive, to trauma and generational trauma, to, you know, contemporary, you know, political barricades, you know, that you can't navigate, to distribution challenges, to funding challenges, to be able to, like, pitch a Palestinian story today in the film circuit is extremely challenging. So for us, you know, big victory in the kind of at the bare minimum, you know, Adhaaf al-Iman is to just create a space where these films are, you know, shown and celebrated and seen by their rightful audiences. And when I say rightful audiences, it's everybody that's discovering Palestinian cinema, but also Palestinians that are here in Dubai, you know, Palestinians that are here in the UAE, who are part and parcel and part of the fabric, you know, of this society, and of, you know, building it, of creating it, and of our identity. So it's not something that we're, like, showcasing, you know, to sort of as a discovery zone. It's really something that is bringing it home and bringing it back to the tapestry of who we are, you know, and what we believe and what we have sort of been a part of and what we remain a part of. The other part is the physical space, right? The physical iteration of a festival, right? There's the films, but then there's the coming together. There's the sharing space. There's the souls that are in the room. There's the people that are, like, hanging out outside, and the different age groups. This is my favorite part of Real Palestine, you know, seeing everything from, you know, the sort of the grandmothers and the aunties, you know, to the, you know, the kids that come and, like, hang out and do, you know, workshops, and, you know, will come and discover a film when we have it for their age group, for young audiences. Those are things that are, you know, that are really important. And it's not just also a nationalistic dimension, right? There's Palestine transcends all of those ideas. Like, Palestine and the, you know, the sort of the struggle for self-determination and the, you know, and resistance to an occupation is not only real and you know, and existential, but also it's metaphorical for everything that we do. So how can we talk about, you know, freedom of thought or social justice or any of those ideas if we don't have Palestine, you know, heart dead center in the work that we do and the practice that we, you know, have put together? So that's, in a way, what Real Palestine, you know, means to Cinema Aqil. And it's also a renewal of intention every single year at the beginning of the year. And most importantly, it's also a proof that, you know, it's not just us doing it in isolation, right? It's collaborators, partners, spaces, you know, volunteers, individuals that come together every year to do this. People who volunteer their time to help us make it happen. It's sponsors who believe in the, you know, the mission and believe in the importance of what it represents and what Palestinian cinema represents for Palestine, but also for the world, you know, and the importance of doing this now. And that's what allows it to exist. So, you know, it's I guess a no-brainer for us. It's always been.
I don't know why everything you said made me emotional, but it was so.
And it's very humbling, you know, Dana. It's really humbling because we just, you know, we've been doing it and we hope that we're doing a good job, you know, and we hope that what we intend with it, you know, comes to life. And we hope also that we do justice to the legacy of the people that, you know, founded it, but also to the filmmakers that ultimately put their lives, you know, that it's not us. Like, we are, you know, we're a platform at the end of the day. Like, without the audience that comes to, you know, to bolster this, and without the filmmakers that you know, literally invest everything into making these films and keeping Palestine like front and center, you know, in the hearts and souls and minds of the folks that come and see these films. We wouldn't have a festival. All of this wouldn't even be a thing. So for us, it's, you know, we're just doing our little part, you know, in making sure that these films actually come home.
I think it's so powerful. Sorry. I just think it's so powerful. At a time where, for some odd reason, it's become quote unquote political to stand for something that feels like it should just be a universal truth. When we talk about justice, when we talk about representation, when we talk about storytelling, somehow it's become this this strange line that you have to tread with caution, when in reality, there's so much that what is happening is showing us that we have more to gain by standing with each other and supporting each other and coming together as especially Arab communities. And I think that's what's so touching about what you're saying, because as someone who's not necessarily Palestinian, the way that you talk about it is in a way that I think so many of us, that especially the millennial generation, that come from a generation of families that probably had to leave their original ethnic home, let's say, were put in private school education systems that lean more towards Western influence of how thought and so many things are a lot of Western influence. And I just think this idea of standing together is this dream. It's this thing that we fantasize about, and we're not really clear on why we don't have enough of it. And it's so refreshing to hear you talk about it in a way that just feels so, yeah, why not? Yani, this is, they're part of us. I love how you talked about them being part of the fabric of what even the UAE is. And I think that's so beautiful, because we are so much, as Arabs, I just feel like we're so much closer to each other than we're choosing to recognize today. And I think that's what's difficult about what's happening.
And sometimes, you know, like everybody thinks of resistance in cinema as just exclusively championing a political, idea or agenda, right? Yeah. And, you know, this could, it can be the case, you're right? And cinema is that. Cinema is ultimately always an extension of some sort of, you know, political dimension. And everything is political, you know? But I also think there is a simplicity to resistance of being portrayed a certain way or accepting, you know, a certain portrayal of our region and of, you know, like showcasing, to me, a film like Farha, right? Mm. Like, it's extremely painful, but it's also extremely dignified, right? Because there is this rejection to this idea of a downtrodden, you know, Palestinian past, you know, and it rejects this idea of, you know, a land without a people, for a people without a land, right? This idea that gave birth to the Zionist, you know, visual, even ideology. I'm not even going to talk about, you know, because this is not the space for that, but even like just in the concept of the film, right? She used a lot of magical thinking and a lot of, you know, creative license to, you know, even the way that the costume design was done. It was, you know, it was rejecting this idea that it should, you know, like you're not allowed beauty, you know, in your recollection of your past outside of romanticism and outside of nostalgia. Like there is inherent beauty that we owe it as programmers, as curators to celebrate, and beauty is a thing of life. It is the thing, the stuff of existence, you know, that we strive for. And I think that part is something we're so pragmatically sometimes also allergic to, that, you know, we do have to, like, you know, have a message, and we do have to have this very clear, like, political thought that we're putting forth, that, you know, sometimes, you know, should be allowed that space, that license, that sort of almost like sentimental license to grow into what it will become for an entire generation, as you say, through the celebration of the moments that we can't articulate necessarily in the language or the political language of the past, you know, whether it's like pan-Arabism and the films that represented that or the music represented that, there are still parts of it that speak to our consciousness. We listen to an Umm Kulthum song and we feel like, oh, you know, there was a point in our history that we were united. We don't know what that means today, right? Mm. So we are clearly yearning for something. And today witnessing a genocide and today seeing how we have, you know, effectively as a region been, you know, abandoned by supposed safeguards, you know, that are supposed to not allow this to happen. So, you know, it's a region that, from a film perspective, you know, Arab Cinema Week this year was really hard to put together because it was, you know, it was really bleak, and our region has been bleak, you know, for a long time in terms of the way that films are made. But there was this sort of bleakness in the isolation of it, you know, like a region that through the films have been asked to fend for themselves, you know. So I think that's the part that is both painful and hopeful at the same time, that there is this curiosity, there is this need to come together, and we're looking for ways of coming together, right? And we don't have the answer. And I think that's okay. And I think it's okay for programmers and storytellers and writers and creators to relish in the beauties, you know, because that is worth holding on to. That's worth preserving, and, you know, ما يستحق الحياة in a way. What deserves that. Life.
I love that. Wow. I feel like we went through most of the things I wanted to go through, but as someone who I would say successfully has done a great job of really embedding themselves in what today has become the UAE's emerging cultural landscape, because to your point, it's still something that I feel like is collectively being written. I hate the term advice, but what insights would you share with young creatives or potentially entrepreneurs that are looking to make an impact, specifically in the Emirati community? They don't have to be Emirati, but just being in the UAE's landscape.
Look, I mean, we've had, alhamdulillah, you know, the sort of the luxury, the fortune of transcending, you know, just being based here in Dubai. You know, we've been doing programming. We've done programming in Qatar and Doha. We've done work in Saudi and in Riyadh, in Al-Ula, and most recently in Bahrain as part of Muharraq Nights, you know, and we've had these different moments, you know, of reckoning. We've also done a pop-up in Amman, which was very small. You know, and we collaborate with the larger region, you know, quite extensively. And I think, you know, the thing that is always a great reminder when you do collaborate with different, you know, types of institutions and also see yourself through the eyes of others in another, in a new context, is to be reminded of the simplicity of what your initial intention could reap, you know. And I think for us, it's the reward of doing something that gives people, I guess, an outlet that they may not, they may not seek and they may not realize, you know, is something they want, right? But there is a common denominator, everybody that walks through our doors, that, you know, is looking for something more, is looking for something deeper, is, you know, people don't come to us accidentally. You know, we're not a cinema that you know, you're walking through the mall and then you're like, okay, you know, what are they showing? Like, let's just walk into a film, which is, you know, audience behavior here. Like, this is how people make decisions about films. We are a cinema that people come to with intention. And I think, I guess, the only wisdom I have to share or, you know, can reflect on right now is staying true to your intention, you know, as much as possible, and remembering what things bring you back to that intention. Because sometimes the daily grind of the work and the quotidian of putting things together, because, you know, our work is like caught between the, you know, eternally, like, hopelessly romantic and the pragmatic, like, ruthlessly pragmatic, you know, and it's 90%, you know, Excel sheets and operations, you know, and systems, and 10% like, you know, arts and magic. So sometimes it's good to know what things or what people or what partners bring you back to that magic, to get you closer to that intention. And I wish I knew this, you know, earlier on. Like, I wish I had my trusted sort of go-tos earlier on in the process that, you know, would maybe help steer me back to, you know, confidence and intention and saying yes and no more resolutely in the beginning.
Muthena, do you consider yourself brave?
I don't consider myself anything.
Really?
I just consider myself, you know, invested in what I do and very much like, you know, kind of immersed in the moment and the moment of folks that trust me with their time and their space. So I don't know, you know, I think time will tell and maybe not.
I usually end my episodes on a final question that I ask all my guests. What would you like to ask me? Based on the conversation that we had today, what would you like me to consider?
What I would love to always, like, you know, from folks I admire and, you know, folks that I really, you know, feel a sort of affinity to their work and their ideas. I always would like to see what it would look like, what the world would look like should the magic wand be in their hands. So what I would love to find out, you know, from you, Dana, is if you had that reset button or the magic wand, like, what is the one thing you would change in today, in the world today? You know, like, what is it, what world order would you, I don't know, uproot or change or transform?
Wow.
It could be very simple. It could be like, you know, I would remove the color, you know, blue from everything, or I would stop this from happening.
I mean, obviously, immediately, I would, this whole notion of the industry of weapons wouldn't exist, period. But I think more importantly, I have an issue with borders, and I want to explain that. I love that people and cultures and ethnicities carry so much individuality in what makes them them. And I think there's so much to celebrate in our differences. But I feel like in the way that our borders and our passports and however you want to call it work today, it imposes this caste system on the way you view yourself and the role that you play in the world before you even get a chance to discover or figure it out for yourself. You're automatically plugged into a system that has already been predefined for you, and predefined in a very, what's the word? Arbitrary way. The powerful today weren't the powerful yesterday. You know what I mean? And that is something that continues to change. And I feel like this is one of the most damaging systems to humanity, because it also imposes this entitlement to privilege. And I think that influences the way that everyone walks through life, no matter who you are. So yeah, I mean, honestly, I would love for that to be something that is either removed or in some way equalized, because the way that it functions today, I find honestly ridiculous and damaging.
Absolutely. That speaks a lot to, you know, to the work that we do every day, like to the work that I'm, you know, personally kind of invested in through cinema as a medium. But it is very close to my heart because we are also very... we're so used to it. We're so conditioned, you know, by it. And being here in the UAE and being here in Dubai, you know, everybody has that experience. Like everybody is, you know, somehow a byproduct, or they're, you know, they're sort of the regional kind of common denominator is this, you know, sort of the tragedy of paperwork, right? And that paperwork means so much of how you exist in the rest of the world. 100%. And in Dubai, sometimes you forget about that, right? Mm-hmm. Or sometimes it's like everybody has this common denominator that you kind of don't really reckon with it. And you don't realize how oppressive it can be until you step out into a context where that is your first, you know, sort of definition as a human being. So yeah, thank you for sharing that and putting it so eloquently.
Yeah, it's interesting because even with the way that you say it and just in reflecting on it, it's for me, it's the difference between living and surviving in so many ways for so many people.
Thank you so much, Dana.
Thank you, Bethena. Thank you for your time. Thank you for this conversation. I feel like you gave me so much to consider. if I liked you before, I love you now. Like, you're such a beautiful human. Thank you for the work that you're doing. Thank you for being, I think you're a brave woman. I think you're brave not because of what you choose to say, because of how you choose to say it. Because I do think that film, whatever context you are in it in, you don't have to be the filmmaker, but any context that you come into this industry with, I think it comes from a place of vulnerability. And it's a choice to be vulnerable in a space like this that you have to make. And I'm very grateful that you've done that. Thank you. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you for considering what we do that. And thank you for your intentional approach to what you do as well. Like, that's something I really celebrate and is close to my heart. So it's a privilege being here.
Habibti, thank you. And thank you to everyone who's listening. As always, thank you for the privilege of your time. If you enjoyed the episode, please do subscribe wherever you're listening to, Your engagement always helps. Until next time, I hope you found something to consider.